James Rollins back with us. We're going to talk about a number of things, including modern witchcraft and also the extermination of witches. That's what they've tried to do. And he'll be back with us in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with James Rollins. He decided to become a writer as a young boy, immersed in the scientific adventures of Doc Savage, the wonders of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, and pulps such as The Shadow, The Spider, The Avenger. He honed his storytelling skills early, spinning elaborate tales that were often at the heart of pranks played on his brothers and sisters. But Jim first pursued a career in veterinary medicine, graduating from the University of Missouri Great School and establishing a very successful veterinary clinic. This hands-on knowledge of and interest in medicine and science helped shape his research and scientific speculation that set his books apart from others. Here he is back on Coast to Coast. James, always a pleasure. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic, George. Thanks for having me back on your program.
Oh,
always a delight.
My pleasure indeed. Missouri doing well in basketball, huh?
Finally.
Good team. Anyways, your books are novels, but they're based a lot on fact, aren't they?
They are. I mean, I think any story, you know, needs to be grounded in reality. And I'm always, you know, looking for, you know, two things. I'm looking for that historical mystery. I'm looking for, you know, maybe a piece of history that ends in a question mark, something that can maybe solve within the pages of the novel. And I like to talk to historians and researchers and archaeologists to try to find out what the real story is behind these little mysteries and seed them into my books. And then I try to pair it up with some science that might tie into it. You know, makes me go, what if, where's that headed? Again, I'll talk to researchers, and I'm notorious for saying, hey, look over your shoulder. You know, tell me what you're working on now. I don't want to know what was on the research paper you published, you know, 3 months ago or that book you wrote a year ago. You know, tell me what you're working on right now, because I want to know, you know, where we're at the cutting edge, where we're headed. And I'm surprised sometimes what these scientists will admit, including some things I learned for this book.
And the latest one is called Crucible, right?
Correct, yes.
And that is it part of a series?
It's the 13th book in my Sigma Force series. And Sigma Force, they're a group of former Special Forces soldiers that have been secretly recruited by DARPA, the Defense Department's Research and Development Agency, sort of the cutting-edge military tech agency. And they hire these former soldiers to be basically field operatives to protect against various threats. And in Crucible, they're faced with a pretty big challenge, one that Stephen Hawking at one point described as, you know, if this event ever occurs, it's going to be the worst event in history of civilization.
Oh,
Elon Musk said if this ever comes about, it's going to lead to World War III. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has stated that whoever controls this event will control the world. And what this event that's featured in Crucible, the science that you're going to see in this book, besides the history of the Spanish Inquisition and witches, the science is the fact that we're really right now at the cusp of seeing the first true human-like artificial intelligence. And in this book, there's a murder of a U.S. ambassador in Portugal, along with some scientists. The attack sends a young researcher named Mara on the run with her creation, which is this rudimentary AI named Eve. And as these teams are trying to hunt her as she's running across Europe, it's up to Sigma Force to rescue her and potentially stop her evolving AI, because Eve is growing very rapidly. She's either going to turn into something godlike or into something very demon-like.
Right.
And then the book confronts the mysteries tracing back to the Spanish Inquisition and the ultimate question facing humanity. You know, what does it mean to have a soul?
And I think AI is going to come along very quick, very quick. And, you know, there are a number of people who are concerned that it may happen too quickly. How about you?
And that is the cautionary tale of Crucible, is that very topic. Is, you know, the, you know, artificial intelligence right now, you know, it's everywhere. But the current form is mostly harmless. But that's not going to last. We're seeing rapidly these machines getting smarter, more capable. And, you know, they're going to soon see them exceed human levels of intelligence. And when I was doing my research, I had about 22 different AI researchers from one coast to the other, and including a couple out in Europe. they were willing to talk to me, and then I would pose this question to them: when do you think we're going to cross this threshold? When are we going to see this first AI that might compete with us at the level of self-awareness and human intelligence? And the range went from anywhere from 5 years to 15 years, which is typical from some of the other research I was doing online, from other researchers, just as a general poll. But two of my sources, very reputable sources, one on the West Coast and one in the Midwest area, both of them admitted that they think we've actually crossed that threshold already. Now, what was creepy enough on that is that they showed me proof. They showed me things they were seeing in research papers that were being released, things that were happening in the marketplace, that they were firmly convinced that we've already crossed that threshold. So that was one of the reasons I figured I better write this book now, is that if this is coming about, maybe we need to talk about exactly what this danger on the horizon is going to look like, what we might do to try to prevent this from becoming something catastrophic for the human species. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write this book.
Well, you did a good job with that, James. And speaking of books, there's a very infamous book that talked about the persecution of witches, something that you researched a lot of. How bad was that?
Well, what's interesting is that prior to about the 1400s, it was rare for anyone really to persecute witchcraft. It was around. People were sort of accepting that there were some, women out there that were using, pagan knowledge of herbs and medicines to treat people, but they weren't being persecuted. It was about the mid-1400s, in the 15th century, that we began to see a fundamental change in this view of witchcraft.
Was that because of the Spanish Inquisition?
Not just from the Spanish Inquisition. It was all because of one book. There's a book called the Malleus Maleficarum, or to translate that, it's the Hammer of Witches. It was a book written by a priest. It was written in 1487, and the book basically is like the witch hunter's Bible. It laid out how to find witches, how to test witches, how to persecute witches, how to
maim them, basically, right?
Exactly. And the main treatise of this book was the worst heresy of all was not to believe in witches. So if you didn't even believe in witches, if you suspected that this was not, the witches didn't exist, that alone can get you condemned. Now, this book by itself probably wouldn't have caused much trouble, except that its appearance occurred the same time of Gutenberg's printing press. So this book was one of the books, besides the Bible, that became mass-produced and mass-distributed across Europe, all the way over to the Americas. And it was that wide distribution of this book, this witch hunter's Bible, that pretty much ignited what became a four-century-long persecution of witches across Europe and eventually spread to the Salem witch trials in the U.S. So that one book has been attributed to the death of 60,000 people. Some people call it the bloodiest tome, bloodiest book in human history.
These people were basically, were they executed?
They were executed, yes. Well, the typical, and this is sort of the thing I learned from talking to some of the researchers, that most people think the Spanish Inquisition was the worst perpetrator of these atrocities, these deaths. But the Spanish Inquisition actually, they judged a total of a little over 100,000 people over the course of these 400 years. But only 2% of these, which is roughly about maybe 2,500 to 3,000 people, were actually sentenced to death. Across Germany, across England, across Scotland, much worse. They had many, many worse atrocities associated with that. So the Spanish Inquisition is a lot of interesting history. It started with Torquemada, was the first Grand Inquisitor, very brutal. Most of the deaths that are attributed to the Spanish Inquisition, the brutalities associated with the Spanish Inquisition, can be tied to Torquemada's reign. But over time, over these four centuries, the Spanish Inquisition, oddly enough, became more liberal. They became more tolerant of allowing witches to exist. And why in Spain and in the Spanish Inquisition that there wasn't that many deaths compared to Germany or England or Scotland, was their philosophy was that if you admitted you were a witch, you would be punished, basically almost like a slap on a wrist. Mm-hmm. On a wrist. You might be banished out of the city that you were, the village you were living in. You might be, flogged a little bit, so to speak, but you weren't generally murdered or burned at the stake or poisoned. This was only people that refused to admit they were witches. So over time, people just realized, I'll just admit I'm a witch and avoid the worst of this punishment. And that pretty much satisfied the Spanish Inquisition tribunals for the most part.
What was it about the basically what they tried to do to witches that captured your mind?
Well, two things is that, back when the worst of the witch persecutions that occurred across Europe, they were hunting heretics and they were hunting witches. Witches are mainly women. They were mainly women that were practicing different healing methods, using, again, usually pagan rites, pagan...
They were almost like herbalists, weren't they?
Exactly. They were just healers. They were generally village healers, people that were just helping out. But here were women that were, questioning the power of the church because they were using these pagan rituals. They were questioning the natural world. And that was oftentimes not tolerated by the strict dictates of the church, which is mostly run by men. So it was a way of controlling women, to silence them, to squash them, is that, if you don't toe the line, if you dare question the natural order of things, you're going to be punished. And
punished they did.
Exactly. And again, most of this probably would have not been a problem except for the merging of this sort of very strict religious text, the Hammer of Witches, combined with technology, the fact that this printing press came about. If the printing press had never been invented at that point, that book probably would not have led to this mass execution of women.
And where does modern witchcraft stand now, James, in your opinion?
Well, modern witchcraft at this point is to me, it's dealing with, I use in the book a quote from Arthur C. Clarke. He says, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. At this point, I've got an iPhone in my pocket. I don't know how it works. It seems pretty miraculous to me. If I took this iPhone back even, 30, 40 years in the past, it would have seemed like something magical.
Like it came from Star Trek. Huh.
Exactly. So at this point, that's what we're dealing with this book, is if there is a sufficiently advanced technology that seems like magic, we may see a modern version of that persecution going on today, and that's the crux of this novel. There's a young researcher named Mara. She has a breakthrough in AI tech. It seems pretty magical. And this is a true part of the story that is interesting going back to the Spanish Inquisition. I mentioned how the Spanish Inquisition later on in its centuries became a little bit more liberal. There's a gentleman, a priest named Alfonso de Salazar Frias, who's also called the Witch's Advocate. He was the one that was instrumental in turning the Spanish Inquisition away from the burning of witches. As a matter of fact, the Spanish Inquisition was the first institution in Europe to ban the burning of witches.
How did he pull that off after so many years of hatred towards witches?
He was a scientist and a lawyer, and he realized that he went from village to village interviewing people that were accused of witchcraft. He realized a lot of this was based on either delusions or on confessions born out of torture, and realized that there's probably not a whole lot of validity to the basis of this, and that there was more used as punishment to silence women, or if there were somebody in your village you didn't like, it was easy to accuse them of witchcraft. So he was the one that turned the Spanish Inquisition around, but not everybody in the Spanish Inquisition liked that.
No, they wanted the old ways, right?
They wanted the old ways, exactly. And there was a core of the Spanish Inquisition that took on the name the Crucibulum, which is the Latin word for crucible. Mm-hmm. Crucible is a vessel that purifies with fire. That's why they took that name. They still believed in the old methods of purifying by fire. And they continued that. They were in direct opposition of the Grand Inquisitor at that time, who had basically said, we're going to halt these burning of witches. But in secret, they became this sort of hard kernel, this crystallized, adamant corner of the Spanish Inquisition that just wasn't going to let that go. And they continued in secret corners in the shadowy corners of Spain to continue this persecution of witches. And when I was doing some traveling in Spain, I asked a question that I oftentimes ask when I'm wandering in a village or a small town in any country, is, tell me a secret about this place. Tell me something that nobody knows about this place. And I was in a small village in the glacial area of Galicia area of Spain, northern Spain, and asked that question. And this woman that I was speaking to, she pointed to a house that had a cross that was burned in the front door. And she says, this is a home of the Crucibellum. This is this Crucibellum still exists in corners of Spain, and many people in Spain do believe that there are that there is still some dark corners of the Spanish Inquisition that still survive in the shadow, that is still looking to persecute heretics, to hunt down witches, again, women that dare to speak out or question the natural order. And so that is the sort of what happens in this book, is the Crucibellum becomes aware of Mara's tech. I believe that if this woman was right about that cross that was burned on that door, and she's correct that the Crucibellum is still out there, that they might not like this woman that's dabbling with this almost magical AI technology, and they might go after her.
Speaking of strange things, don't you live in a haunted house?
I just recently moved into a house. It was a house that was built in 1936. It was the first house built on the street, and there's only maybe 10 houses on the street. It's fairly remote, and it's in the shadow of a structure called Cave Rock. And Cave Rock is a very sacred Indian burial site. Matter of fact, I was doing some work on my property, and I was required to bring an archaeologist to survey where I was going to do some
digging,
gardening, some landscaping, to make sure there were no Indian remains on the property.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
So already this, the property has a little bit of history behind it, and I noticed that in the house that every now and again I'd get that little tingle at the little hairs at the back of the neck that are raised, and I was talking to my realtor, did not inquire about it. I was just talking to the realtor, and she, out of the blue, says, "Jim, have you seen the ghost yet?" And I was like, "What?
Really?"
I said, "I've got this weird, feeling every now and again. What are you talking about? What's this history of ghosts in this house?" She says, "Yes, the owner of the house prior to the person that you bought the house from." Had the house, also had some weird feelings about the house, and had a feng shui expert come to the house to get a feeling or a sense of the propriety of the house, the energy of the house. And they came to the conclusion that yes, there was a ghost in the house. And I said, "Really?" And said, "Yep." And her conclusion was that it was a ghost of a raccoon.
The ghost of a raccoon?
Ghost of a raccoon. It was an animal spirit, specifically a raccoon, and it was very active in the house. And which, again, considering the fact that I'm a veterinarian,
there you go.
It's appropriate to have. If I'm going to be haunted, I might as well be haunted by an animal spirit, specifically one of a little bit of a rambunctious raccoon. So. Now, I still think there's more to the house. One point, I'm going to pursue this a little bit further because there is some strange energy.
But you're not afraid of it.
Not at all. I don't get any sense of malignancy or anything like that. It's just there's just some weird moments of strange energy in the house.
Now, you say, and we're coming up on a break, but you say that there is a threat of modern witchcraft. Now, today, isn't modern witchcraft really just Wicca? And, people who believe in a male-female god?
Correct. And this book really isn't touching so much upon that type of modern witchcraft as I'm more talking about in this book, that threat of AI, this threat of this magical-seeming science. And on the break, I'd like to maybe talk a little bit more about the Spanish Inquisition, specifically about something that I was shocked to learn also during my research about the Spanish Inquisition is that there actually was a Catholic patron saint for witches.
For witches?
A patron saint to protect against witches, protect witches themselves, not protect against witches, but to protect witches.
What did they do with that one? Threw it out?
Oh, no, it's actually a cult in Spain.
All right, well, we'll talk about that, James, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you along with James Rollins. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, but it is his name, James Rollins, R-O-L-L-I-N-S.com. So, James, there's actually an advocate for witches in the Catholic Church during the Inquisition?
There was, and I find that really fascinating that there seems to be a very conflicted relationship between the Catholic Church and witches. In Exodus 22:18, there's the famous line, "Suffer not a witch to live,"
right,
which is basically that you should not tolerate witchcraft and witches should be put to death. It was that line that gave birth to the hammer of witches, this Malleus Maleficarum. But also in the Old Testament, we see King Saul consulting the witch of Endor to find out some information on from the prophet who had died, Samuel. And so again, we see witches being in service to a great Old Testament king. So I went to Spain, and I learned about this cult of St. Columba.
Cult of St. Columba.
Columba. It's C-O-L-U-M-B-A.
Okay.
This cult flourished during the Middle Ages in Spain, mainly again in northern Spain area, and which was basically considered also a bastion of witches, that whole area. And according to legend, Columba was a witch from the 9th century who went out and met the spirit of Christ on the road, and Christ told her she could not enter heaven unless she converted to Christianity. And so she did, but she remained a witch. She was eventually martyred and beheaded for her faith, and because of that, she became a saint, specifically the patron saint of witches. To this day, not only during the Middle Ages, but even to current day in Spain, she acts as a protector for witches, interceding on the behalf of good witches while fighting against those who would corrupt such craft for evil purposes. Now, I spoke to another historian to try to find out, is there any validity to this legend? Is there any historical evidence that St. Columba existed? And this historian said basically that he believed that the cult of St. Columba was based on the fact that there were many women back during the Middle Ages, educated women, who studied the natural world, who sought medicine and herbs. They were drawing upon pagan knowledge. Now, some were accused of witchcraft. They were poisoned by priests. They were burned at the stake. But there are others who, because this is going on, they sought shelter in nunneries and monasteries, where, like St. Columba, they could worship Christ, yet at the same time they were planting secret gardens in these convents and in these nunneries, and they were helping to treat the sick and afflicted. And so there was basically smudging the line between paganism and Christianity. Here are women, nuns, that were, planting the same sort of secret gardens, these pagan gardens, yet because they were within the walls of the convent, they were considered to be, wise women, nuns serving Christ. Yet if those same gardens were planted outside those convent walls and were being cultivated by just some village woman, she was a witch. So they believe that the cult of St. Columba, this legend of St. Columba, goes back to that there were women. There were these women that would normally be considered witches that sought solace, sought safety within convents and nunneries where they could still practice these pagan rites, again, whilst at the same time wearing the cloth of nuns.
How many witches were there, percentage-wise, James, in those days?
Well, again, they attribute the number of deaths to the Malleus Maleficarum at 60,000 souls during the four centuries.
And many of them probably not witches. They were probably just in the wrong place at the wrong time, huh?
Exactly, and there's a history in the Galatial area where I use this quote at the beginning of my book. It says there's an old Galatian proverb from northern Spain. I don't believe in witches, but they do exist. And that is pretty much the philosophy of that area. There are caves in the Pyrenees Mountains of northern Spain that to this day are considered to be areas where Sabbaths are enacted. To this day, people that do believe that witches are still in those mountains, practicing different arts, both from the good side of the Wiccan side and the bad side, and that they're still celebrated up there.
Now, tie this into the Crucible, and how do we get into artificial intelligence? How does that tie in?
Well, this goes back to the fact that the persecution of witches pretty much was a way of persecuting women, especially women that dared question the natural order. And at this beginning of this book, we do see a group of women that have banded together, a group of women scientists in present day that have banded together because, again, even today, especially in the sciences, there's still a lot of persecution of female scientists. A lot of sexism in the scientific world when it comes to women that are trying to do research. There's a lot of sort of Me Too type of issues going on in that field. Take, for example, the woman that won the Nobel Prize for Physics this year. She was the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in Physics in 100 years.
Which is brilliant.
Exactly. So, at this point, the crux of the story is, even though we may not be burning women at the stake today, there is still some persecution going on. So in Crucible, we have a group of women scientists. They actually even take on the mantle by calling themselves Bruxas International. Bruxas is the Portuguese word for witches. They rather than shying away from that designation, they lean into it. Unfortunately, this occurs in Portugal and Spain, and it arises or attracts the interest of the shadowy Crucibellum, the Crucible that still might exist, this sort of hard core of the Spanish Inquisition. Mara, this AI researcher, is demonstrating her craft, her breakthrough she has in AI research, and during that seminar, the Crucible attacks them. It murders most of the women. Mara escapes with her technology and is on the run. And throughout this book, we see sort of the evolution of Eve, which is Mara's AI program. And there are scenes from this in this book from Eve's point of view. From the beginning, we see this sort of cold calculating machine, and we see what potential that could become. And I talked to a lot of researchers about this threat. How close are we to this threat? Some think we're already there. Some think it's going to happen in our lifetime. Sure. And they're all very concerned about what's going to happen when this threshold's crossed. Because once we have an artificial intelligence that's equivalent to our intelligence, it's probably going to become a super intelligence very quickly, and it's going to be almost incomprehensible and potentially a threat. So I posed this question to these AI researchers and said, okay, great. If this is happening, what can we do to make sure that this AI that makes an appearance in the next 5 to 15 years, from becoming a malignant intelligence that's going to share this planet with us? And their answer...
Go ahead.
Their answer, again, was... This came from a founder of Skype, that the answer... And the only answer, we're not going to be able to regulate our way out of this situation. We're never going to be able to regulate people from stopping this from happening. The Silicon Valley has sort of a weird philosophy of, go fast or die slow.
Right. And every 2 years, go faster.
Yeah, just they're pursuing AI. Everybody's pursuing AI at a very rapid pace right now. It's basically almost like a gold rush because it's can be extremely profitable and extremely powerful tool. So everybody's after it. That threshold will be crossed, but the question is, what's that intelligence going to look like, and how's that going to act? And so there are a small core of AI researchers, including the founder of Skype, who believes that the answer is not to just go for AI, but to pursue the harder road to produce the first friendly AI, an AI that's sympathetic, empathetic to humankind.
Is that possible?
That was exactly my question. Thanks for asking that, George.
There you go.
That was my exact. Well, how can you do that? How do you know it's going to be friendly? And so calling different answers from different AI researchers about different techniques they believe that can help with that. And it comes a matter of sort of nature versus nurture. That's a debate that goes on how much of who we are is from our genetics and how much of who we are is how we're raised. And the same applies to this AI that potentially is going to come onto the world stage. A part of way of making it friendly is tied to code, a way of coding your way to try to make it friendly, but also the nurture side, it is how to raise this AI so it's going to be friendly. So I culled all this information from these different AI researchers about the steps necessary to produce a friendly AI, and that's what I used as my template for showing the evolution of Eve in my novel, is by using some of these programs. I'll give you one example.
Okay.
The basis of a lot of human emotions, what drives our emotions, is our hormones. Hormones drive our emotions. So rather than trying to control the emotions of an AI from the standpoint of controlling their or trying to code in emotions, IBM has developed what's called an endocrine mirror program, which is basically a hormonal mirror program. Basically, they're an algorithm that will mimic the hormones we have in our body. And if we can instill these hormone codes into our AI, theoretically, then these hormones then will be what will bring about the emotions we want to engender in the AI. And so that's from the aspect of controlling nature of the AI, controlling the code of the AI, is by imbuing it with these endocrine or hormonal mirror programs so that hopefully it will develop into something that's emotionally stable. Other side, that's controlling the nature side, controlling the nurture side. Again, some of the other answers I was getting from these AI researchers were, you almost have to treat an AI like a child, is first shelter it, you know, produce a virtual world in which this AI can grow and learn slowly about the world at large, versus just thrusting it into the chaos that is the internet today, is keep it somewhat confined like you would a child, and slowly let it mature within this confined environment before you, and layer by layer expose this AI to the world at large, almost like a parent would raise a child. If you raise a child in a safe, caring environment, you're most likely going to have a stable child. If you are very abusive and callous and isolating with this child, you may end up with something sociopathic.
Yep.
So that's the novel is combining both nature and nurture, both code and upbringing, to see this AI come to fruition. Now, it's only a small percentage of AI researchers that are pursuing this. You know, if this book serves anything, it's a cautionary tale about maybe we need to have more scientists pursuing this avenue, because if we do cross that threshold with an AI that's poorly controlled, poorly constructed, thrown into an environment that's confusing to it when it's developing self-awareness, we're going to probably create an invention that's going to be our own end.
Is that what Stephen Hawking was concerned about? The late physicist.
That's exactly what he was concerned about, and not just him. You know, there was a open letter that was signed by
a group of scientists,
300 different signatories,
yeah.
From Elon Musk to Stephen Hawking to leaders of Google and Apple, basically calling out that we need to slow down on our rapid pace towards AI development. We need to rethink this path. We're never going to regulate our way out of this, because at some point, some country, some secret lab is still going to pursue this,
yep,
because it is such a valuable prize. But maybe we need to look at creating this avatar, creating this friendly AI, so that if a malignant AI ever arises, that we have somebody, this AI that can compete, an AI that will be our avatar, an AI that's going to help us deal with any malignancy that does arise.
Something that will save us, right?
Exactly.
How can AI run amok? What could happen to it?
Well, that is the main concern, is that we have very little understanding of what's going on. This was the other thing that really disturbed me, is I kept hearing from AI researchers over and over the term an algorithmic black box. And what that basically means is that even today, we do not know, on some of these advanced AI programs out there, and there's some powerful programs out there that we can talk about, like Google's AlphaGo and AlphaGo Zero. Some incredible AI machines out there already, and what I've learned, they're already past that. But what, even at this point, most AI researchers, they construct the code, they build the machine, they put in data, and an output occurs. they cannot explain oftentimes how that AI came to that conclusion, how it digested that data in such a way that this is their answer.
That's dangerous if they don't know how.
It's so dangerous that DARPA has given $6.5 million to the University of Oregon specifically to try to get a better handle on how AIs think, because they think that is, again, another way of preventing a malignant AI from coming on stage, is we need to understand how it thinks, because right now we do not know. In many cases, this algorithmic black box, you know, it's unknowable at this point. And so that's one concern, is that we don't know how these AIs think at this point. Number two, how are you going to confine an AI? There was an experiment done about 10 years ago. It was called the AI box experiment. In this experiment, there was a researcher in the Bay Area, an AI researcher, very smart gentleman. He was basically put in a virtual chat room and locked in there. There was a cash prize.
That's like going to hell.
AI researchers. Pardon me?
That's like going to hell.
Exactly. It is going to hell. So he offered a cash prize for other AI researchers to challenge him, to see if he could talk himself out, pretending to be AI himself, again, a human level of intelligence.
And trick people.
Could he talk himself out of this locked room, out of this locked box? So AI researcher after AI researcher, they were going to give him a prize if they could keep him locked up. Everybody failed. Every single time, this AI researcher
got out,
broke out of that box. Now, to this day, and I was trying to find out the answers, how did he do that? He will not say what his technique was for breaking out of the box, but it was successful every single time. So if you have a human level of intelligence that was able to break out of this virtual box, a super intelligence is not going to stay confined.
Can't be stopped.
It's not going to be stopped. Because once it can, right now, there's two concerns. At this exact moment, we have computers that are strong enough and fast enough that they are basically thinking, they're doing elementary operations that are, you know, per second, that is equivalent to the human brain. We have that already.
Are they on their own?
We have hardware right now that can compete with our brain.
Hold on for a second, James. At the break, we'll come back for more and phone calls next.